Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. If ever there was a time to work through that stack of books on your nightstand and catch up on your reading, it's now, during this pandemic slowdown. Sarah Volpe is with us to share details of an annual event that is a deep dive into the very latest in our literary options, the Kentucky Book Festival, put on by her organization, Kentucky Humanities. Thanks for joining us, Sarah.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And so first tell us how you and the folks at Kentucky Humanities have figured out a pandemic workaround for this year's festival.
Well, it was a long, slow process that started in March when we all started working from home. Typically, that would be our prime fundraising and planning season for the in-person book festival, which typically takes place in November. And once COVID became a very serious thing to all of us, we realized that an in-person event probably wasn't going to happen this year. So we started watching a lot of Zoom webinars and events online and kind of mentally preparing ourselves to transition the guests that we'd already confirmed and booked, transitioning them into a virtual conference, and then taking our massive accumulation of author application forms and whittling them down to about 50 instead of our normal 200, and then working from there. So it has definitely been a work in progress.
So this year's festival is virtual. First, tell us which platforms you plan to use. I know about Zoom. What else?
Sure, yeah. If it's a live event, we're going to broadcast to our Facebook page. It's at KY Humanities. And we will also be posting any of the videos we record on our YouTube channel. And so we're recording and hosting events through Zoom webinar most of the time. And people can register to join those at kyhumanities.org. I'm also working with our team to make a new website and launch a new website early October. And that will include all of the author info and info about their books and all that fun stuff. We're already hosting events every Thursday on Zoom webinar and Facebook Live, and they're author happy hour sessions, because I thought, if anything, we need to have a glass half full attitude this year.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. The festival, the main festival, is November 9th through the 14th. Is that correct?
Yes.
But you actually, as you just mentioned, you have things happening now. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Right. Well, typically with our event, you're able to interact with up to 200 authors at a time in one day. Plus, we typically host events leading up to the big book fair the week prior to it. So that's an additional, 10 to 12 authors that you can meet. And since we couldn't bring people together to meet in person, we thought the only fair way to do it was to give each of these authors a chance in kind of a roundtable discussion and conversation with other similar authors to get on camera and kind of feel like they're meeting fans in person, even though it's all done online. So that's where the happy hours idea came in. And those are kind of the lead-in events to the big book festival on November 9th through the 14th.
Okay. Can you throw out a few names that people would recognize among your featured speakers?
Yes, absolutely. We'll have National Book Award-winning poet Nikki Finney, who has a longstanding relationship with Lexington and is a fantastic poet. She had a new book come out earlier this year. We are going to have, I got lucky with a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist this year. We're going to have Nicholas Kristof and his wife, Cheryl Wu Dunn, whose book Tightrope will be discussed. We're going to have Chris Hamby and Eric Eyer, who both had books released within the last couple of months. And we will have David Blight, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. We'll also, on the more kind of fun, quirky side, have J.R. Ward, who writes romance novels and lives in Louisville and has a very huge, loving fan base. And Terry Brooks, who is the New York Times bestselling author of the Shannara series, which MTV has made into a TV show.
And I see a last but not least here, John Grisham.
Oh, yeah. How dare I not mention him? Yes, John Grisham will be with us a little bit, too, in conversation with Kim Edwards. And so that should be fun. His book, just A Time for Mercy, comes out in October.
Good timing.
Yeah, I believe that's the Pelican Brief character. It's a continuation of that story.
Ah, okay. So, Sarah, what if we miss an event? Will everything be recorded and then available later on demand?
Yes, everything will be recorded and available on our YouTube channel. It'll also all be available on our Facebook page. Our YouTube and Facebook, it's at KY Humanities, and all that will be free and available to view.
Okay, and one more time, where can we go to get information about the festival?
Yeah, the best place is our website, kyhumanities.org, and you can also follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at KY Humanities.
Sarah Volpe, Kentucky Book Festival Director and Special Projects Coordinator at Kentucky Humanities. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
We're putting on our own mini book festival on this week's Eastern Standard. We have conversations with a poet inspired by Kentucky history, a pair of novelists sending up images of fortune tellers, ghosts, pizza joints, drug dealers, and the author of a nonfiction illuminating perceptions and perspectives about America as seen from the coal communities of Eastern Kentucky. First up is Tom Eblin.
Poet Linnell Edwards is a professor of English at Spalding University in Louisville and the Associate Programs Director of the School of Creative and Professional Writing. She grew up in Anderson County and is descended from the McAfee family, some of Central Kentucky's earliest European settlers. Her new collection of poems from Broadstone Books is titled This Great Green Valley. In these poems, Edwards draws on stories about the hardships of her ancestors and other Kentucky pioneers. In the book's final poem, she explores the same landscape two centuries later, when she was a child pleasure boating on the Kentucky River. Linnell Edwards, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, I'm curious, what were you hoping to accomplish with this collection of poems?
For myself, I think poetry is always a process of discovery. So I wanted to know more about the McAfees and the world that they were part of. And so I set upon that and I did discover that. I learned a lot about Kentucky that I didn't know, including the fact of the earliest days of Kentucky in the late 18th century were not precisely the Kentucky that came down to us in the 19th century stories of heroes of the frontier and et cetera. And so for me, understanding my family or part of my family's role in the settlement of Kentucky was important to me. And I think that the McAfees themselves are a kind of example of one way in which that's this part of the country was settled. They're a piece of the puzzle about our founding. And I think some of what I discovered tells me a little bit about why we are where we are now and what we still need to think about.
Yeah, well, obviously, poetry is a work of the imagination, but you did a lot of historical research. In addition to making sure your history was accurate, you used some phrases from old documents as jumping-off points for poems. Tell us a little about that, your process.
Yeah, there is two poems, I guess, that are essentially sort of found language poems. That is, I took snatches of language from, in one case, letters from pioneer families to relatives largely back in Virginia, and excerpted them as a way to sort of convey the mosaic of violence and hardship and fear that they experienced and kind of collaged them. And in another case, I use excerpts from a series of letters from, I believe, General Benjamin Harris to the governors of Virginia over the course of, I think, four governors, as he's trying to, on the Kentucky frontier, address the increasing incursion. Well, incursion is the wrong word because it suggests that the natives were, in fact, trespassing, but it was, in fact, the opposite. But his battle on the frontier against the native tribes, and using just their language and compressing it and creating this kind of collage resulted in I think, a powerful and intense sort of experience that collapses quite a lot of different experiences.
Mm-hmm. Well, several of the poems are about famous incidents in Kentucky history, such as the Siege of Bryan Station, the kidnapping of Daniel Boone's daughter. And then there's a legend of John Swift's silver mine. What intrigued you about these tales?
Various things. I would read several accounts of the same tale. For instance, the capture of Daniel Boone's daughter, which is a tale largely depicted as a tale of heroism on the part of Daniel Boone and the posse that went after the girls. But as a mother, I imagined what it must have been like for the girls' mothers to see them returned. And almost immediately, the voice of those mothers, who themselves were probably not really that old, they might have been 40, seeing the return of their girls who very foolishly went outside the station and, you know, put themselves in extreme danger, and how they might have felt. In the case of the silver mines, that was something I knew nothing about. But as soon as I shared that with some of the members of Filson Historical Society, where I did a whole lot of my research, and I'll just put a PSA in there for the Filson Historical Society, is a marvelous state treasure. You know, as soon as I shared that poem with some of them, they go, oh yeah, my grandfather, my great uncle, you know, they were always looking for silver. And I hadn't heard about the legends of silver in the Kentucky Hills. And it's really kind of the stuff of History Channel specials. There's not really actual historical evidence. It's a lot of, you know, legends of this and that and tales of this and that. But what's interesting in its persistence as a tale is I think it does contribute to the one of the true narratives about the founding of Kentucky and the sense in which people were trying to get rich in Kentucky, if not through land purchases, then through lost silver mines or other means where they saw it truly as a place they might get rich.
Well, what are some of the other surprises about Kentucky history that you discovered in the process of doing this?
I don't know that I realized how violent it really was in terms of the clashes. By the latter part of the 18th century, things are very, very horrifically violent. Early in the settlement in Kentucky, if we think about the earliest surveyors coming into Kentucky in the late 1760s, the early 1770s, there's a sense of kind of wary goodwill among, I think, the surveying teams and parties and the Native American tribes, to say, okay, you guys be cool here and we'll be cool about this and you can kind of hunt here and we'll do this. And it seems all right. And then as it becomes apparent the white settlers aren't going to play by the rules, it becomes incredibly violent. And that surprised me. Mm-hmm. Growing up in Kentucky, you always hear about dark and bloody ground, which is not what Kentucky means. That was something I did learn. Kentucky actually means something like great meadow or beautiful place or fair meadow. And dark and bloody ground comes from a speech by Dragging Canoe at the Treaty of the Sycamores. And it is bloody. It's really horrific.
Yeah. Well, the last poem, which is a very kind of a long narrative poem, is about your experience as a child kind of pleasure boating on the Kentucky, which used to be a very popular thing to do when the locks worked. And tell us a little about that.
So the poem itself was something I'd been working on for quite a long time. I drive across the Kentucky River on 64 several times a month, probably. And at the time I was going back and forth across the bridge there on 64 grows across it, you know, and I always look at the Kentucky River because I know where I am. And I look down, and one day driving across it, going towards Lexington for something or another, that first lines came to me still and flat as a summer day. And I just realized, whoa, there's a whole lot more here. And I started writing, I guess 6 or 7 years ago, I started that poem. And I began piecing together my experiences. And for a while, it was a bunch of shorter poems. And I thought, oh, this will be kind of a short book, and it'll be a lot of separate poems. And then I put it back together again. And I realized it's a single long poem. And it was a really special and unique part. And for a long time, I didn't know where I was going with that, because I couldn't tell that it was saying anything really interesting. And what I realized it was saying that was interesting was that I was really happy at that point in my life. And I'm a happy person now. But the story of the family in the boat on the Kentucky River on a Saturday in the very early 1970s, the family doesn't stay happy, though they don't become unhappy in ways that are frightening or damaging. And I realized I was happy, and we really were happy, even though things got a little sad later. And it became a poem about a place, and I thought it resonated with the work about the pioneers, insofar as I'm looking at the deep histories of a place in terms of its geology and its myths, like the legends of silver, and its, you know, social history in the settlement of and movement of people.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, you know, I think you obviously struggled with in chronicling that social history was kind of the real deep racism of that area towards Black people and Native Americans, and you write a little about that. And I'm just curious, you know, in addition to that and some other things, what were some insights you gained about Kentucky history that you would think other Kentuckians should know about?
Well, I think historically, I think everyone has to make up their own mind about how they regard certain incidents, like the betrayal of treaties or violence. I think that one of the sort of forgotten stories about often the founding, and I have taught the first half of American Lit in university settings, where you introduce that introductory literature to students, and you talk about, you know, the founding narratives and why people came to America and what they were looking for. And we tend to think, well, they're looking for opportunity and religious freedom and, you know, a better way of life. And all that's certainly very true, but also to get rich. And there are, you know, one of the poems in the pioneer section of the book is about the land speculators and their schemes to buy up and get as much land as they possibly can. And I think understanding that is important, that yes, the pioneers were brave people, and in many cases, like the McAfees, they got their warrants for land as a result of their service in the French and Indian Wars and then the Revolutionary War. And they had no other intention but to settle their lands and to build a, you know, build a family and a farm. But there were many wealthy Virginia folks who were just set on buying up as much land as they possibly could and reselling it at a higher price and piecing together, you know, warrants and preemptions to do so. And so I think that's good to remember. And in terms of our complicated relationships with Native tribes in Kentucky, I think we have to remember what happened there and what would later happen and how the groundwork was laid even in those early days. I don't address so much, although this is a part of Kentucky's early history, is the fact that many enslaved people accompanied those pioneer families, and there were many enslaved people at Fort Harrod. And I think we have to remember that, and that Kentucky wasn't, it wasn't a foregone conclusion that Kentucky was going to be a slave state. We didn't have an obvious plantation crop right away. And the influence of the church, it was sort of hotly debated, but we decided ultimately to become a slave state. And I think it's important to begin to understand why that might have been. And that's sort of, that's a little bit beyond my pay grade at this point to speculate entirely about that. But I think it starts with telling those stories and understanding the earliest histories.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. It's Lynelle Edwards of Spalding University, a poet, and her latest book is This Great Green Valley from Broadstone Books. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Tom Eblin's author interviews are offered in partnership with the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning, where he serves as literary liaison. Learn more online at carnegiecenterlex.org. Joining us now is Richmond attorney, pizza shop owner, and now novelist Wesley Brown to tell us about his new book, Hillbilly Hustle. Thanks for joining us, Wesley.
Thank you for having me, Tom. Appreciate it.
And tell us first about the plot of Hillbilly Hustle. What is the book about?
Hillbilly Hustle is about a pizza shop owner in Richmond, Kentucky, named Knox Thompson, who owns a shop called Portho's Pizza. And as the book plays out, he somewhat unwittingly stumbles into selling marijuana from his pizza shop on South 2nd Street. And there's a little bit of the based on a true story sort of situation with the book concept.
Sounds like a Richmond resident might hear a few or read a few things in the book that are familiar. Did you draw on what you know about the area to develop the book?
I did. The book is, what takes place in the book is, of course, pure fiction. It's a novel, but it is set in Richmond. My family are co-owners of Apollo Pizza, and Portho's Pizza, which is the shop that Knox owns, is pretty obviously based on Apollo. And before we owned the shop, there was a fairly open secret in town that you could buy marijuana at Apollo Pizza. And that's something that I'm an attorney in town in Richmond as well. And I heard about it for years back before we ever owned the place. And that's not a practice that is ongoing at Apollo since we've had it. But it struck me that that was a pretty good basis for a novel. And so aside from changing the name of Portho's, there's a lot of local landmarks and that sort of thing here in Richmond in it. Purdy's Coffee plays a role in it. There's a scene in Purdy's Coffee. They go to Babylon Cafe. There's a point at which they go down to Berea and go by the what everyone around here calls Mexican Hardee's. And I lean pretty heavily into the reality of Madison County and this area.
So when you first had the idea of writing this book, what got you past your doubts? How did you finally come about deciding, you know what, I'm going to do it?
The fact of the matter is, like a lot of people who write a book, this was my fourth try.
Uh-huh.
And this, I guess this was the first time I really hit on a premise that worked well. And, you know, to some extent, it was something where maybe I wasn't up to it until this point in my life of writing. But it worked. Early readers of it were pretty excited about it, and it changed a lot. It's published with West Virginia University Press, and my editor there was a woman named Abby Freeland. She worked really well with me, and I had a couple of other folks who worked with me to refine it quite a bit. But the premise worked. The idea really worked, and I really had a lot of fun writing the book.
What would you say was the hardest scene to write?
It's really the climax of the book. There's a scene where there is a armed confrontation at Portho's Pizza, and writing that level of tension and writing the dialogue of what people would say and sort of how they would feel under that level of stress, I found that very tricky. You don't want to have anything be over the top, or you don't want melodrama, and you don't want to overwrite something like that. So I found that scene really tough to write. The day-to-day scenes, the humor and the dialogue, and which is a big part of it, I can sort of write that stuff in my sleep. It's the real serious scenes that I find the most challenging, that I agonize over getting everything in the right place.
Well, in that process of writing, did you ever come to that point where you feel some part of your brain refusing to take a hard look at a sentence or a phrase for fear that you might have to change it?
You know, not really. I write fairly freely. And I don't take it too seriously. I will say I stay up late at night sometimes, and I get a little foggy for lack of sleep and have to go to bed. And I find that those are the times when I'm not writing well, that's the time I really get stuck. I did one of the last things I did before publication, and it was after I had signed with West Virginia University Press, but it was before I turned in my final manuscript. is I went out to a writer's workshop in Portland, Oregon. It's called Tin House. It's a pretty well-known writer's workshop. And my instructor there is a guy named Ben Percy, who's a pretty well-known writer. And I used to have two protagonists and two sides of the book. And he said it was lopsided. He said one of the protagonists was much better. And with about a month to go before my deadline to turn it in, he persuaded me to cut the book down from 100,000 words to 70. And I actually cut it in half. I cut it down to 50,000 words and wrote back 20,000 words. And so the finished product at the last was very different. And a lot of people said, how could you do that? How could you get rid of half of your book? And my response was, I knew he was right. When he explained it to me and why I should do it, I knew he was right. And my editor said, it's ambitious, but I think it's a good idea. And she was really happy with it after I did it. And that's the finished product. And it worked, and it was daunting. But I'm pretty ruthless when it comes to cutting my work if it's the right thing to do. And so I go where what I think the right thing is. I follow that path if I can.
It's always good to have those other sets of eyeballs looking at your work, though, isn't it?
Oh, yes, sir. It was, you know, I don't want to give away all the credit, but I had a lot of collaborators who helped me with this book. But I'll give you a good example. There's a female tattoo artist named Darla is one of the key characters in the book. And Big Fish Tattoo here in Richmond, I consulted there. And it's Rob Gilkey is one of the tattoo artists. And he actually read all of the tattooing scenes for me. And he came back and said, look, I think you did it well. And I really liked it, but here's a couple of things where people in the industry might say, that's not exactly the way we would say it. And he recommended to me changes. And that's just one example of a lot of people who gave me help like that. But I'm very keen on authenticity. So I got some help here locally from a local business person who made the book better. And I'm not shy about asking for help when I need it.
Well, writers often say that they learn things while they're going through the writing experience, which it sounds like you did. And I wonder, did you learn anything new while writing Hillbilly Hustle?
You know, I'm a lawyer by trade, and so I leaned heavily on my legal experience, but I didn't know a lot about guns. So I actually conferred with a couple of friends of mine who know more about guns and are law enforcement officers, and they told me about guns. I mentioned the tattooing part. I learned about that. The opening scene is at a poker game in Jackson County. And I played in the World Series of Poker years back, so I drew from my own experience on that, but I read a lot of poker books to make sure I didn't get things wrong. There's agate collectors in here. And I spent a lot of time talking to some agate collectors and found out where you get the good agate in Kentucky. And mostly it's in Estill County, but a little bit of it's in Jackson County. And I learned about that. So I learned about all kinds of things. And I'm really pretty meticulous about wanting to get facts right. I don't want anyone to say, hey, he got this wrong. And that's one place where maybe I do freeze up a little bit is I so hate for someone to come behind me and say, I got something factual wrong that I do for a novel. I research pretty hard to make sure that I'm getting things correct, that it's authentic.
Well, I'm pretty sure that people in the region are going to want to read this. How can they find it?
You can find it in local bookshops. I try to really promote local bookshops, and Joseph Beth in Lexington has signed copies in the local author section. Carmichael's has it. I also would recommend bookshop.org. That is a really great, relatively new website. It is an online bookseller that aims to somewhat compete with Amazon. But a great deal of the money they bring in goes to the local bookshops. And so when you buy from bookshop.org from your home, you're still supporting your local booksellers.
All right. Wesley Brown, author of Hillbilly Hustle. We thank you so much, Wesley.
Tom, thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Coming up after the break.
Well, let me ask you something. Have you raised a family? You'll do what you have to do to make a living for your family. And that's exactly what we've done.
Eastern Kentucky Points of View, as reported in the new book, Appalachian Fall, Dispatches from Coal Country on What's Ailing America. It's published by the Ohio Valley Resource. And Kentucky-born author Karen McElmurray on her new book, Wanting Radiance.
It's about fortune-telling. It's about ghosts. It's about lost love. It's about lost family.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hixson Funson, Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
We're back with some more snapshots from Kentucky's literary scene with the annual Kentucky Book Festival now underway, the main event coming up in a few weeks, all virtual. We'll have more details on that in a bit. This next book is close to home for us here at WEKU. It comes from our partners at the Ohio Valley Resource. From member station WFPL in Louisville, we're joined by OVR managing editor Jeff Young to talk about their new book, Appalachian Fall, Dispatches from Coal Country on What's Ailing America. Thanks for joining us, Jeff.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
And if you would first bring our listeners up to speed about the Ohio Valley Resource, the mission, your areas of coverage.
Sure. We launched in 2016 with partner stations in Kentucky, Ohio, and West Virginia. And the goal was twofold, really. One, to see if public media can do more together by collaborating and add some journalism capacity across the board, and also to try to fill some of the void that was being left in journalism as, sadly, we saw a lot of newspapers and other outlets cutting back and doing less local coverage, and especially coverage of rural issues and small communities. So that's how we got started. We have a team of eight journalists with seven stations. Seven stations, three states, two time zones, if you want to look at it that way.
And as I understand it, it's essential that your reporters, your OVR reporters, live and work in the communities that they cover. Why is that important versus the Appalachian story being told by what we call parachute journalists with no real connection to the region?
Mm. We know national journalism is very important, obviously, but when it comes to covering a lot of local and regional issues, there's just no substitute for being there. And that means not just being there when the story happens, but being there so that you really understand the communities that you're covering. And I would argue that that's especially important for the Appalachian portion of the region that we cover, because Appalachians, you and I are both Appalachians, Tom. I think, you know, sometimes we have a bit of a chip on our shoulder about how we're depicted in national media, and maybe rightly so, because there's a lot of harmful stereotypes about the region. We want to try to counter that by covering the place with, you know, a special sensitivity toward concerns about how some of the real challenges that we face here, and we certainly don't shy away from the real problems and challenges here, but how you depict that and how you describe that to an outside audience is very important. Too often, I think Appalachian people are depicted as to blame for their own circumstance, that somehow they're lazy and shiftless and deserve what they get or something like that, when in fact those of us who live here know that there are smart, resourceful, hardworking people who are working on the many challenges that we face here, just as there are everywhere else in the country and in the world, right?
Right. And let's dig into this book. Coal, it's mining, it's production, and it's culture.
have been a major OVR focus, and among the stories that are captured in the pages of Appalachian Fall is that of Charles Wayne Stanley.
We're not just dumb old coal miners. We're not. We might not have the education, but we're not dumb. It's time that we be recognized for what we have contributed.
So, Jeff, tell us about Mr. Stanley.
Well, Mr. Stanley was one of the miners that my colleagues interviewed when we were first investigating the resurgence of black lung disease. Black lung disease is something that should have been eliminated from that industry and from this country long ago. It's entirely preventable if you follow the proper safeguards. Unfortunately, however, it's long been a problem, and once someone contracts it, it's fatal at a certain point. And what we learned in our investigation was that far from fading away, black lung was roaring back, especially in this central Appalachian region that we cover. And that's due to a number of factors about how mining has changed, exposing miners to more of the deadlier dust that is produced when they encounter other layers of rock around the coal. That combined with a decline in oversight and safeguards proved deadly for many miners. And what I was really attracted to about Mr. Stanley is, you know, here's a guy who was sitting in a black lung clinic in Virginia and talking about his deep pride in what he and his fellow miners had contributed to the country and his desire that we recognize that, recognize their contribution, that they helped to build this country. And he's got a good point.
It was coal miners that put this nation on the map. Without coal, there would have been no Industrial Revolution. There would be no New York City. There would be no L.A. There would be nothing on these grounds of this United States, this great nation that we live in, if it hadn't come from the backs of a coal miner.
In the book, you note that coalfield activists are using the term energy sacrifice zone to describe the places where they live and work. What do they mean by that?
Well, I know that's something that would rub some people the wrong way. If you live in one of those regions, you don't want your community to be thought of as a sacrifice zone. But what I think people mean when they use that is look at the price that these people in this environment has paid in order to supply energy to the rest of the country. Black lung is one of those costs. The scarred landscape left behind by mountaintop removal and other surface mining, the streams that have been poisoned by slurry spills and acid mine drainage, on and on and on. There are these legacy costs associated with the energy production that has happened in this region for a century. Who's going to be left with those costs? That's really the key question at this stage in the industry's lifespan. We're seeing the decline and, I would argue, the end of coal as something that produces energy for this country and for certain parts of the world. We'll still see coal production to produce metals. The metallurgical coal that's used in making steel is still around. But very rapidly now, we're seeing the end of coal as a major fuel source for producing electricity as we shift to other cleaner forms of energy and we necessarily address climate change. So who's going to pay for all of those costs left behind? Are we just going to be sacrificed and left with these costs of damaged lungs, damaged lands, or are we going to be recognized for the contribution that we've made to the country? And are we going to get some help to make these people whole, make these communities whole, and give them a future?
And just to personalize it, to put a face or, in our case, put a voice on that price, Charles Stanley also talked to you about the heavy price that he has paid as a coal miner.
Staying on oxygen 24/7, dying of suffocation. That's what I've got to look forward to because I've seen it too many times, coal miners. My wife's grandpa, watched him die, watched him take his last breath, eat up with black lung. I watched my uncle die with black lung. you literally suffocate because you can't get enough air.
So, Jeff, this is just one example of the stories contained in the book. Briefly, tell us about a few others.
So we look at a whole number of effects of these legacy costs and other challenges that communities in our region face. And we really are getting at the point that these are not just challenges and problems that matter for those communities and for this region. These really are problems that America as a country needs to address. And that's for a number of reasons. We need some system nationally to assist communities in an economic transition. I argue that we don't really have a good one, that once an industry plays out in a region, they're kind of on their own. We saw that happen with steel mills and other forms of heavy manufacturing. We saw it happen with timber. We've seen it happen with fishing. And now we're seeing it happen with coal mining regions. And there are only so many times that we can do that and just say, okay, you're on your own, before there's a serious backlash in our politics and in our society. In short, I think when you cut communities loose and treat them as disposable, treat them as sacrifice zones, you create a ripe environment for authoritarianism, for demagoguery, for things that are a threat to our democracy. And we're seeing that. We're seeing that now in our politics and in our society. So we need a plan. We need a way to help people with what's called a just transition, a path forward. It's not a handout. It's not welfare. It's doing what's right, recognizing the contributions that these people have made in the past, and assisting through the national means, through the national treasury, with a path forward. And, you know, like I said, smart, resourceful, hardworking people in these Appalachian communities are already doing this work. What's really needed is the means to scale up the solutions that they've discovered and developed, and make them rise to the scale of the challenges that they face.
So how and where can we find Appalachian Fall?
Well, it's at a bookstore near you. I love my local bookstore, and I'm sure a lot of listeners do as well. I encourage you to find your local bookseller. However, I also recognize we are in a global pandemic, so getting down to the local bookstore might not be as easy as we'd like. Simon & Schuster is our publisher, their imprint Tiller Press. You can order via Simon & Schuster or wherever you buy books online.
Jeff Young is managing editor of the Ohio Valley Resource, and I should mention that we're welcoming our new OVR WEKU partner reporter, Corinne Boyer. She's just getting settled in. We'll be hearing from her soon. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
Working in a coal mine, going down, down, down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down. Working in a coal mine, going down, down, down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down.
5 o'clock in the morning, I'm already up and gone. Lord, I'm so tired. How long can this go on?
Daddy working in a coal mine, going down, down, down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down.
Karen Sawyer McElmurray hails from Hagerhill, Kentucky. Today, she teaches English at Gettysburg College and at West Virginia Wesleyan. Titles to her credit include The Motel of the Stars, Surrendered Child, A Birth Mother's Journey, Strange Birds in the Tree of Heaven, and now Wanting Radiance, published by the University Press of Kentucky. And she joins us from Catonsville, Maryland. Greetings, Karen.
Greetings. Thank you so much for inviting me today.
Okay, let's get into the book. What's it about?
It's about fortune telling. It's about ghosts. It's about lost love. It's about lost family. And it's about this murder. The murder sort of provides a narrative arc for the story. It's Maricel Loving is the major character of the book, and she sets out to find out what happened to her mother, who was shot and killed when she was 15 years old, and she's never known her father. She wants to know family. But underneath that, you know, all that's the plot stuff. Underneath, I like to think the book is about radiance itself, about light, whether it's the light of memory or of trust or of identity or of just plain being safe in the world. And none of those things are something that Maricel has had. So that's the Heartwood, I think.
This is a novel, but is the story that you tell somehow rooted in real-life experience? Where did the idea for the novel come from?
Oh, yeah. Years ago, when I was studying writing at University of Virginia, I wrote a short story. I was never very good at stories because they have to be contained, you know, and I want to go into the past and the future all over the place. But I wrote a short story, and it was called The Black Cat Diner, and that was based on a diner and gas station that my great aunt, whose name was Deli, owned and operated. And the family story was that she had a cheating card playing husband. And he'd be gone, he'd be back, he'd be gone, he'd be back. And finally, one night, she locked the doors of the diner against him, and he fell asleep in the seat of the truck with the motor running and died there. So that's what the story was about, and I was always just so interested in that story and went back to it, and it opened and opened to become the longer form of a novel. And, of course, I've always been interested in fortune-telling and have gone to have my cards read as often as possible. So that's another layer.
I found an endorsement of Wanting Radiance by Lexington's Crystal Wilkinson. She's the author of The Birds of Opulence.
Crystal is wonderful.
And she says of the book, this book is brimming with haints, lies full of magic, and Karen McElmurray's storytelling is the most haunting of all. Haints, haunting, storytelling. Is that an apt description?
Oh, very much. I mean, Crystal went right to it, right to what it's about, and I was just so grateful and honored for her to write the blurb. It's literally about haints, about ghosts. We have the ghost of Maricel's mother, Ruby, who comes in the most unexpected of ways to haunt her. She starts hearing her voice and being prodded forward in a direction to seek her past. But it's also metaphorically about being haunted. I've just said Maricel's haunted by who she's never been, who she's not been able to be, and what she wants most for herself. Like myself, she's been kind of a roadie. She's lived here, there, and yon. So it's about being haunted by your own self, trying to find out who you are.
You know how when you've read a book, it kind of stays with you for a while. And as you're walking around, driving around, doing your chores and whatnot, you're thinking about the influences of the book. What do you imagine will be in the mind of the reader who's just put down Wanting Radiance?
Oh, I think about that all the time. I think about that during this time of chaos that we're living in, and chaos and darkness. And I thought, what does this book bring to people right now in this particular world that we're in? And guess what I hope it brings is that possibility of love and peace inside. I hope that it's a story of coming to terms with finding a place of home and settledness inside, not out.
Karen, in our emailing before the interview, you mentioned that you would like to touch on writing and community. What did you mean by that?
I mean, again, that we're in a world of chaos and change. And what role does art play in that? I think we need it more than ever. We need art-making artists. And because we need that art, we as a community of artists, we need to be unified. We need to help each other. We need to help each other be seen, heard, felt. That's what I mean by community. And I hope in any way I can to bring that help to the world.
Karen Sawyer McElmurray, author of Wanting Radiance, published by the University Press of Kentucky. Thank you, Karen.
Thank you so much.
This hour-long focus on Kentucky literature was inspired by an event that we talked about in the beginning of the show. In case you missed that, I was talking with Sarah Volpe. She wears two hats at the Kentucky Humanities Council, Special Projects Coordinator, and in this instance, Director of the Kentucky Book Festival. And here again is what she told us about how this year's festival is working in light of all the pandemic restrictions.
If it's a live event, we're going to broadcast to our Facebook
page. It's at KY Humanities. And we will also be posting any of the videos we record on our YouTube channel. And so we're recording and hosting events through Zoom webinar most of the time, and people can register to join those at kyhumanities.org. I'm also working with our team to make a new website and launch a new website, and that will include all of the author info and info about their books and all that fun stuff. We're already hosting events every Thursday on Zoom webinar and Facebook Live, and they're author happy hour sessions, because I thought, if anything, we need to have a glass half full attitude this year.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. The festival, the main festival, is November 9th through the 14th. Is that correct?
Yes.
Kentucky Book Festival Director Sarah Volpe. Next week on Eastern Standard, our series Teaching in a Pandemic is heard from Kentucky public school teachers and superintendents about the struggle to continue educating our kids during these strange, strange times. Well, now we turn to students, people like Daylen Kozer, a senior at the Carter G. Woodson Academy in Fayette County, who, in learning online, has discovered the self-discipline he expects to need in college.
It helps you with, like getting rid of distractions. And like focusing and zoning in on your work when you're at home, when there's a lot of other distractions, as like electronics and like TV that could be going on around you.
We'll hear from UK psychiatrist Lon Hayes about quarantine fatigue, alcohol, and drugs.
We know that some people will increase their alcohol use in this setting. Others will increase their drug use in this setting. But we also find that some people are less tempted to use.
Chris Begley will be back with his Future Tense series, and next week we'll hear how Puerto Rican communities look to themselves to recover in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria.
Local civil society organizations were being very effective in providing relief as opposed to large institutions like FEMA, right? So I was curious about what makes these organizations be so effective.
And another from our selection of series, the latest in our year-long monthly exploration of the outcome of the 19th Amendment ratified 100 years ago. This time, looking at the pivotal event that determined
who got to speak truth to power and who got to interpret the Bible and who got to speak in public.
It's all on next week's edition of Eastern Standard, Thursday at 11 a.m. and 8 p.m., Sunday at 6 p.m., anytime online at esweku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Have a topic you'd like to suggest to us? We'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin, and thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.